Hello, it's Thursday the 27th of January and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. North Korea has fired two apparent short-range ballistic missiles towards the East Sea in the regime's sixth show of force this month alone. We'll have the latest details shortly. Local courts this week sided with two minor presidential candidates to stop a one-on-one TV debate between the two leading candidates. We'll discuss this development for today's Korean Politics Digest. And then for Explore Korea, our travel contributor will be taking us to some lesser-known locations featured in popular K-dramas. We'll have all that and more on today's Korea 24. North Korea again fired off what appears to be two short-range ballistic missiles today, its sixth round of missile tests this year alone, prompting concerns from both South Korea and the US. To update us on the rising tension in the regions, as well as our other headlines of the day, we have our KBS World Radio news editor, Koo Hee-jin, joining us on the line. Hee-jin, hello.
Hello, Jang-woo.
First, can you give us the details of what we know so far of today's launch?
Well, the Joint Chiefs of Staff said Thursday that North Korea fired off two projectiles presumed to be short-range ballistic missiles towards the East Sea earlier in the day. The JCS detected the launch from the area of Hamhung in South Hamgyong province at around 8 a.m. It added that the military is closely monitoring the North Korean movement and maintaining its readiness posture. Military authorities in both South Korea and the U.S. are reportedly analyzing the launch to determine their range and type. This comes just 2 days after the regime launched two rounds, presumed to be cruise missiles. It also marks the North's sixth provocation this year, including four rounds of ballistic missile tests.
What kind of response has there been from the South Korean presidential office as well as the U.S.?
Well, the Standing Committee of the President's National Security Council convened an emergency meeting immediately after the launch, presided by National Security Advisor Tohun. The committee expressed deep regret over the North's repeated launches that go against the international community's demands for peace and stability on the peninsula. The members urged Pyongyang to swiftly return to dialogue on denuclearization and to desist from further aggravating it. Still, the statement this time did not define the tests as provocation nor condemned the North's actions. The U.S., on the other hand, did not hold back its censure. U.S. State Department spokesperson Ned Price told Seoul-based Yonhap News Agency on Wednesday that North Korea's latest test, along with others this month, violate multiple U.N. Security Council resolutions and pose threats to neighboring countries and the international community. Still, he reaffirmed Washington's commitment to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula through dialogue and diplomacy.
Staying with North Korea, the regime appears to have suffered cyber attacks with disruptions in internet access for its key organizations continuing for a second day. So, Hee-jin, what's been happening exactly?
Well, as of 7 a.m. Thursday, internet disruptions were observed for a second day on websites for North Korea's official newspaper, Rodong Shinmun, the Korean Central News Agency, Foreign Ministry, the Air Korea Airline, and Minjujoseon, the newspaper published by the North Korean cabinet. This is quite a reversal. As our listeners are aware, North Korea has been cited on multiple occasions as instigators rather than victims of malware attacks. North Korea's official websites were intermittently connected and disconnected, only to be stabilized much later in the day. Reuters reported on Wednesday that North Korea's internet appears to have been hit by a distributed denial-of-service or DDoS attack. According to Junaide Ali, a cybersecurity researcher in Britain, the alleged attack took place for about 6 hours on Wednesday morning, and all traffic to and from North Korea was taken out at the height.
Meanwhile, Washington has finally named a new ambassador to South Korea after leaving the post vacant for more than a year. The U.S. ambassador to Colombia, Philip Goldberg, will be filling the post. Can you tell us more?
Well, according to a source familiar with the issue on Wednesday, President Joe Biden reportedly tapped Goldberg for the post and that U.S. State Department has asked the South Korean government for an agreement on the appointment. The senior official at the presidential office in Seoul said the government has been notified of the nomination. Washington will make an official announcement once Seoul grants the agreement, and Goldberg would then take steps for his confirmation at the Senate. Goldberg is a seasoned career ambassador, which is the highest rank bestowed on U.S. Foreign Service officers. He served as coordinator for the implementation of U.N. sanctions on North Korea from 2009 to 2010 during the Barack Obama administration. And together with Christopher Hill, also another former ambassador to South Korea, they midwived the September 19, 2005 joint statement of the six-party talks. He learned the ropes of diplomacy under the late hardliner Richard Holbrooke.
Let's move on now to news related to the pandemic. The number of daily infections in South Korea hit a record for a third consecutive day, doubling in size in just 3 days to top 14,000 as the highly contagious Omicron variant continued its rampage across the nation. Heejin, can you break down the figures for us?
Of course. The Korea Disease Control and Prevention Agency reported 14,518 daily new infections on Thursday, a jump of more than 1,500 from the previous day to raise the daily cumulative total to 777,497. The government ruled out reinforcing social distancing to rein in the wave, citing relatively fewer numbers of serious cases and deaths. Despite the spike in daily infections, the number of critical cases fell by 35 to 350, remaining in the 300s for a third straight day. Senior Health Ministry official Son Young-nae also noted the potential negative social impact and related costs should they further tighten measures. The government will continue to keep an eye on developments over the upcoming Lunar New Year holidays before they mull changes to regulations. Currently, private gatherings of more than six people are banned, while restaurants and cafes must close up shop at 9 p.m., This scheme is to end on February 6th.
Meanwhile, ruling and opposition lawmakers on Thursday began their deliberations on a 14 trillion won supplementary budget aimed at helping small businesses that have taken the brunt of the impact of the government's antiviral measures. And in his speech in Parliament, Prime Minister Kim Buk-yeom called for a speedy approval of the bill. Can you tell us more?
Yes, Kim spoke at the opening for the extraordinary session and urged lawmakers to promptly pass the $11.6 billion extra budget bill submitted by the government, stressing that additional support is inevitable amid spread of the Omicron variant. He said most of the extra budget will be first covered by Treasury bonds as a matter of urgency, which will be repaid with an expected tax surplus beginning April this year. The Prime Minister also urged lawmakers to begin talks on ways to lower monthly rent, choking small business owners amid the prolonged pandemic, saying relief funds alone can't resolve financial woes.
Moving on, the Supreme Court has upheld a four-year prison sentence for Jung Kyung-shim, the wife of former Justice Minister Cho Guk, who was convicted of a series of corruption charges. So what's the latest on this?
Well, the top court on Thursday finalized the sentence issued by a lower court on 15 charges, including obstruction of duty, forging a private document and violating the Capital Market Act. With the verdict, the top court recognized all charges of academic fraud related to her daughter's college admission. The court's ruling came 2.5 years after prosecutors kicked off an investigation into corruption allegations surrounding the former justice minister's family. During her first trial, Jung was sentenced to 4 years in prison and was slapped with a fine of 500 million won and a 140 million won forfeiture. An appeals court then upheld the four-year sentence but reduced the fine to 50 million won and the amount of forfeiture to 10 million won.
And finally, turning to some business news, a new law punishing corporate management for failing to prevent serious disasters went into effect on Thursday. This, of course, comes after the devastating partial collapse of a high-rise apartment building under construction in Gwangju earlier this month. So can you tell us the details?
Yes, owners of workplaces with more than 50 workers or construction sites where expenses exceed 5 billion won will be subject to the Serious Accident Punishment Act, or SAPA. Under the law, an incident that results in at least one death or in two people requiring more than 6 months of treatment for injuries in the workplace will be regarded as a serious accident. The new law will hold business owners or CEOs responsible for the work-related deaths of their hires with a prison term of 1 year or more and a fine of up to 1 billion won. The corporations or institutions involved will also face a fine of up to 5 billion won. Meanwhile, the nation's major business organizations expressed deep regret over the SAPA and called on the government to make improvements to minimize any side effects. The Korea Enterprises Federation said in a statement that the law was enacted without any improvements, adding that the guidelines that the government has provided are vague and misleading.
We'll wrap it up there for our news briefing. Thank you for those updates.
Thank you.
The presidential elections are only 41 days away now, and with little separating the two main candidates, an exclusive televised debate had been agreed by the two camps for next week, but injunctions made by two minor party candidates had blocked it, arguing that they should be involved as well. We'll take a look at this development for today's Korean Politics Digest, as well as how the so-called one-team efforts from both parties are going. And providing us with his analysis is our expert guest, Affiliate Professor Kim Byung-ju from the Hanguk University of Foreign Studies, who's joined us in the studio now. Professor Kim, hello. It's good to see you.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So the minor party presidential candidates, An Cheol-su of the People's Party and Shim Sang-jung of the Justice Party, successfully stopped the top two candidates from holding a TV debate on their own. Lee Jae-myung of the ruling Democratic Party and Yoon Sung-yeol of the main opposition People Power Party had agreed to hold a one-on-one TV debate sometime next week. That was going to be separate from a series of TV debates being organized by the National Election Commission featuring all four candidates.
Right.
But the one-on-one debate has been stopped by local courts that granted injunctions filed by An and Shim. In response, the three main terrestrial broadcasters offered to hold another four-way debate instead, but the PPP have resisted, even suggesting a non-televised one-on-one debate be held with E. Lee's camp had rejected that idea, but latest news suggests that he has now accepted it after all. Professor, it's still a developing story, it seems, but if we go by what we know so far at this point, what do you make of the court's decision, and what's your response to this? Who are perhaps the losers and winners of the situation?
Right. I guess I can respond to your question in three different dimensions. First one is in the big picture and normative sense. We voters need to know candidates' ideas. We also need to know the characters of these politicians who want to represent us. So from that perspective, having four people debating with one another probably is a much better idea rather than just narrowing down the scope. While we have four major candidates running, we just only narrow down the two leading candidates only. That kind of limits our choice altogether. So election, for those people who study politics like me, it's more than just a political victory. It's more than something that's about political victory, but rather it's about policy choices and consensus building. So if An Cheol-su and Shim Sang-jung can add to the ideas of Yoon and Lee, it just gives public much wider scope about what kind of policies that are available And then maybe whoever becomes the president, we can use that consensus being built through this kind of process, actually, you know, to borrow that idea and implement those ideas about policies. So in the big picture and the normative sense, this broadening of the scope of participation into this debate from 2 to 4 is a good thing.
Right. For sure, so right. You essentially agree with the court's decision.
Right, right. It's a good thing for the public. Second dimension in responding your question, one thing that this is more like a practical or a positive, you know, calculating, you know, aspect of this is that this may have something to do with for these two candidates, An Chol-soo and Shim Sang-jung, they're desperate to join in,
right?
Because money. You may wonder what I'm talking about, but you know, let's talk about the campaign finance regulation here in Korea. If you get more than 15% of the votes, you can have your campaign spending reimbursed fully. All you spend in presidential campaign, the government will, the taxpayers will pay back.
Okay.
Okay, so your expense will be fully reimbursed. If you get votes between 10%, 15%, you will get half of what you spend in the campaign reimbursed. So, by the way, we have a cap for campaign spending. All candidates, they cannot spend more than 51 billion won this time.
Okay.
This is dictated by the Election Commission, you know, incorporating inflation and everything. But 51%, 51 billion won cap for everybody. And if you go over 15% of the votes, you'll be fully reimbursed.
Okay. So there's incentive for you to try and get that 15% in whatever way you can.
Right.
That's perhaps
even beyond 10%, right?
Sure.
At least you'll have half of your spending reimbursed. So it's a money question at the same
that's
time.
That's quite a cynical look at this,
but
perhaps.
It's a fact, I guess, right?
We can't ignore it. Sure.
Right. I mean, you're running for election and it's your money or your voters' money or whatever. Mm. You care about that as well. So there is the second dimension. And then third dimension in responding to that question would be, as you mentioned at the end, you know, how do these the other two leading candidates respond to? Different analysis here, but they say Lee Jae-myung's camp, Lee Jae-myung's team are saying, oh boy, this court decision is not helping us. Because Lee Jae-myung is a great debater. Everybody knows that. So Lee Jae-myung, Yoon Sang-yeol, one-to-one was supposed to be a boxing match where Lee Jae-myung was supposed to beat up Yoon Sang-yeol big time from Lee Jae-myung team's perspective. This was going to be a big time opportunity to show the strength of Lee Jae-myung. But if you have four candidates, it's all diluted. So great disappointment in terms of calculation.
Also, he'd have to be defending from various sides as well, because An and Shim will be making their own attacks to Lee Jae-myung as well.
That's very important, another critical factor as well, what they call crossfire, right? Like all these bullets will be flying from the other three candidates towards Lee Jae-myung. So that's really disadvantageous. Yoon Sang-yeol's case, there were some analysts saying if An does really well, Yoon Sang-yeol could actually lose some of the votes. But others were saying, well, we have seen, you know, An Chol-soo twice before, but he was never a great debater,
right?
They say.
In previous presidential elections.
Right, right. So will we see a different character or not? That's questionable. We'll have to wait and see. But all these different calculations of, you know, strategy, money, and normative arguments, it's all mixed into this, you know, interesting analysis of the court decision this time.
Is it really that important, do you think, these debates? Is it really going to change the face of the race, do you think?
In my own personal experience, I did change my mind every time, twice before. The two previous elections, when I watched the debate, I did change my mind. I suddenly realized this particular candidate that I had supported was dumb, not smart enough to be the president. So I decided to divide the vote for the other candidate. And that happened twice. So I'm not sure I'm that representative of the population. But
and we won't name names of who you thought was.
No.
Okay, so it is an interesting development. We will see if there is a perhaps separate debate. What do you think of that idea, though, of having non-televised debates separately?
More debates are good. I mean, you know, I don't care as much about the formats as much. But I thought initially having only two candidates is not a productive thing. But if we have four several times and then maybe two untelevised, whatever, I don't know. I mean, I believe in live broadcasting, and there is a much about dynamic debate and everything. But the more information we can get, whatever format, whatever, I think it's positive for me as an individual voter.
Okay, so these latest developments also come as Yoon is gaining slightly momentum in the polls while Lee's numbers are stagnating. Mm-hmm. Amid that situation, the ruling Democratic Party chair, Hong Yong-gil, announced party reform measures on Tuesday. He said he himself would not seek re-election in the 2024 general elections, explaining that there's a need for a generational change both within and outside the party. It's part of an effort to replace the so-called 586 generation, which refers to politicians in their 50s who experienced the democratic movements of the 80s and who were born in the 60s. Mm-hmm. They're essentially being accused of holding perhaps too much power and influence, mm-hmm. While being out of touch with the public. He also said that the party will not field candidates in the March 9th by-elections in three districts, seats which are vacant because of the controversies involving the party. So it's been seen as a way to show that the party is moving forward and ready to refresh. What do you make of this announcement?
Song Yong-gil's his own announcement of him not running for the parliamentary election, and then party not nominating candidates for the by-election itself, I was a little bit surprised. I was thinking, how appealing would this offer be to the voters? You know, what kind of immediate impact it can have. But having thought about that, also I couldn't help myself thinking DP, Democratic Party, the ruling party is desperate right now. The party leader, Song Yong-gil, is trying to offer whatever he can, quite desperately. And that's all about this, what they call the box phenomena, right? The Lee's poll numbers cannot go over and beyond certain numbers.
Right.
And with that, they are getting really desperate. I can see that. But together with that, the idea of generation change, I think that's very important indeed. So the other colleagues of Song Yong-gil, together with him, saying that we need a change of generation, I think it's hitting the right button. It's hitting, identifying the right issue here. But can they actually appeal to the voters? That's a separate question. But in terms of analysis, when we say that's the right button, that this is what I mean. Very, very, very frankly, unlike previous presidents, Moon Jae-in, he's enjoying quite a high number in terms of the approval rating. So what does this mean? And then at the same time, the voters say they have to change the ruling party, right? There's a high number, more than 50% of people say we have to change the ruling party. But 40%, they say this president is fine.
Right. It's an interesting situation where the sitting president is having better poll numbers than the next potential president either side, really.
Right. Yeah. So we need explanation, interpretation of what's exactly happening. The way I see it, Moon Jae-in, as a person, as an individual president, he's a fine guy. As a character, he's modest, he's soft-spoken, he's humble, he's a fine person. The thing is, public just do not like people around him, people that he has appointed. Those people who have mentioned, let me get into an example, some of those people who have said Soviet army was a liberating army and then U.S. army was occupying force. Those kind of things. Some kind of like
extremist.
Right. So public do not like Moon's people. Public do not necessarily dislike Moon Jae-in himself, but Moon's people. And what we call Moon's folks and people, colleagues, they are the 586 generation. They should go. A lot of people believe they have done their job. This is the generation that brought in democratization into Korean politics. They have shown the popular politics in a good way. You know, people power and everything. They have done their job now. It's now for them to go. Why? Because they have become an elite class that has been working on eternalizing their power and privilege. after achieving all these great things.
Mm.
So people see great twist, great negative legacy now growing.
Hypocritical legacy.
Hypocritical legacy. That's a great way of describing it, right? So they see that legacy growing now, and they want to see this generation go. So Song Yong-gil and his colleagues, leadership of DP, has identified the right problem. But the thing is, what can they do? And in terms of what they will do, these words that they are saying, what they are going to do, are they going to actually be as appealing and as no-nonsense solution to the public or not? I think there's a big question out there.
And it seems, though, they are making the pushing the right button, looking to sacrifice as well, and
right.
move the party at least in the right direction together.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, in the PPP camp, we're seeing more splits, it seems. Despite Yoon improving the polls, there remains internal strife. Last week, the presidential candidate Yoon met with his primary rival and a veteran lawmaker Hong Joon-pyo to try and garner his support, but doesn't seem to have gone well. Hong is said to have asked Yoon to publicly declare that he will sternly deal with corruption allegations against his mother-in-law. He also put forward some names he wanted for the upcoming by-elections we mentioned earlier, and this all seems to have been too much for Yoon. Yoon is also not on good terms with the prominent former lawmaker Yoo Seung-min. In a recent release of phone call recordings between Yoon's wife, Kim Gun-hee, and a reporter of a YouTube channel, she commented that Yoon took part in shamanistic rituals. This has caught some traction. So ultimately, all of these incidents, they're hindering Yoon's efforts to unify the different factions of the party to make the so-called one-team strategy. We haven't even mentioned the party chair, Lee Jun-suk,
right.
But we won't go into that as well. What do you make of that situation? How important is it for Yoon to try and bring the party together, or can he actually go on his own?
Indeed, that's the big question right there. And this, what's happening, what you have just described in terms of what's happening inside PPP, this has been the same story from the beginning, right? Ever since the election of the new party leader last year and the formation of the party to prepare for election, this has been ongoing story. Why is this happening? My analysis is that there's no exception to this argument. Not even Yoon Sung-yeol, Lee Jun-suk, Hong Joon-pyo, Yoo Seung-min, everybody we're talking about, they have the same problem. That is, they seem to have this megalomaniac misunderstanding of who they are. because they're not Lee Myung-bak, they're not Park Geun-hye. What I mean by that is, in Yoon Sung-yeol included, they don't really represent any really strong force. They don't have firm, loyal voters. Go out on the street, look for Park Geun-hye's loyal supporters. There are people out there after 5 years. And those are people, there are people out there who have, like a fond memory of the can-do spirit legacy of the time that Lee Myung-bak represented.
Mm.
But Yoon Sung-yeol, Lee Jun-suk, Hong Joon-pyo, Yoo Seung-min, they're not those kind of people.
Mm.
They're just politicians here. But they seem to believe that they could, they may have these kind of things behind them and they want to go their own way and stuff. Like Lee Jun-suk, for instance, right? Supposedly, he should represent young Korean voters. And I'm sure he believes he's the main face of this new generation. And he represents them. Does he really? How many people actually support Lee Jun-suk? It will depend on how well he does for this election. He's not there yet. Hong Joon-pyo, he's popular because he's interesting. He's entertaining. But what does it stand for?
Mm.
I'm not sure. Yoo Seung-min, he's smart, his policy-rich ideas, he's a great brain. But as a political force, what does it stand for? I'm not sure. So these people are kind of like overlapping themselves with the political figures in the past, previous presidents and everything. And they may be thinking they can do something. My point here is that PPP has to remain unified. It has to go unified. Otherwise, people are not going to forgive this time.
So
they're not going to bear with the continuation of this party's disarray going forward. Even after, let's say if they win the election, next government coming in under PPP, if they continue to show this kind of disharmony and everything, people are not going to forgive that.
Right. Okay, so even though Hong Joon-pyo and Yoo Seung-min, they might not have this fervent following, they still need to come together, you're saying. You're still saying Yoon needs to try and bring them together for the future of the party rather than just this election.
Lee Jun-suk, Hong Jun-pyo, Yoo Seung-min, Yoo Seung-yeol, their future is with PPP. Their future cannot stand outside PPP. And broken, shaken PPP is not going to work for them.
Interesting. Okay, finally, let's look at one more development today before we go. The Supreme Court has upheld a four-year prison sentence for Chung Kyung-shim, the wife of former Justice Minister Cho Guk, who was convicted of a series of corruption charges. They include obstruction of duty, forging a private document, and violating the Capital Market Act. With the verdict, the top court recognized all charges of academic fraud related to her daughter's college admission as well. And this comes 2.5 years after prosecutors kicked off the investigation into corruption allegations surrounding the former justice minister's family, which can be described as a major factor in the ruling Democratic Party's fall in public in popularity and public trust. What is your reaction to this ruling now?
Quite interesting, because leading up to this final verdict by the Supreme Court, you know, there were indications that Supreme Court judges may not actually accept some of the critical evidences, but they did this time, right? So that's a big surprise. And in the final analysis, this ruling, we know Cho Guk is Moon's member, Moon's team member, and Lee Jae-myung has expressed his sympathy for Cho Guk. So therefore, this time, the way court acted, it has affected Lee Jae-myung negatively, for sure. And we know Yoon Seong-yeol, whether he accepts it or he agrees or not, he's the one who started the whole process of, accusing, making legal accusations to Cho Guk, right? Mm. So, legally speaking, Yoon Seong-yeol is the winner. Mm. So, court has taken side with Yoon Seong-yeol this time. In terms of who's winning, who's losing, in terms of calculation in this campaign process. So I think that's what the ruling stands for at this point. But of course, ruling has greater meaning for all of us, as we discussed earlier in the earliest segment of this broadcast before. But we'll see how it pans out further. But for now, it looks like it will affect Lee Jae-myung negatively, and it will probably benefit Yoon Seong-yeol positively.
Okay, we'll have to wrap it up there. Thank you for your analysis, as always, Professor. We hope you have a great Lunar New Year holiday, and we'll see you next week.
Same to you as well. Thank you very much.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index fell 94.75 points, or 3.50% on Thursday, ending the day at 2,614.49. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also plunged, losing 32.86 points, or 3.73%, to close at 849.23. On the foreign exchange, the local currency weakened 5.1 won against the dollar, ending the day at 1,202.8 won. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
We turn now to Korea Trending, our daily segment where we round up some of the other news stories that have been trending online in Korea. And to bring us those stories, we have once again joining us in the studio our guest contributor, Jenny Sa. Jenny, it's good to see you again.
Good to see you as well, Jang-ho.
Okay, today we're going to go straight into our stories. What do you have for us first?
First, Denmark will lift all COVID-19 restrictions starting February, Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen said in a press conference Wednesday local time, as the government no longer categorizes the coronavirus as a socially critical disease. The change will include easing restrictions on face mask requirements on public transportation, as well as the need for vaccine passes when entering museums and restaurants, pending parliamentary approval. The measure follows the lead of other European countries, including the UK, Ireland, and the Netherlands.
Okay, so one of the first countries to try and transition back to pre-pandemic normal life, it seems. Would this change also affect those travelling to Denmark?
While domestic restrictions will be lifted for the most part starting in February, some restrictions for entering into the country will still remain in place. Exact details aren't confirmed yet, but sources say that they are likely to require a negative COVID-19 test from those who aren't fully vaccinated or who have been recently infected.
How are the daily COVID-19 numbers in the country, incidentally?
So Denmark continues to report a record number of daily infections, but health authorities say that rate of hospital admissions no longer poses a threat, and the number of intensive care patients and deaths continue to drop. And according to National Board of Health Director Soren Brostrom, Denmark has an enormously high immunity, and probably at least 80% of the population from cradle to grave is well protected.
Well, we'll see what this decision will do to the COVID-19 situation in the country, and if it can handle the situation, and then that will be encouraging news for other countries around the world as well. Let's move on to our second story. It's about the launch of the digital driver's license today. What more can you tell us?
The mobile versions of the driver's license are now available on your phone as the six-month pilot operation of the digital driver's license begins Thursday. The digitized license will be accepted wherever physical identification cards are currently accepted. The operation will go through a trial period in Seoul and Daejeon and will expand nationwide in July.
Okay, so that means no need for a physical card anymore. But the questions that always get raised with any sort of digital identification system are the security issues. How does South Korea plan to address such concerns?
So the Ministry of Interior and Safety and the Korean National Police Agency have taken several measures to address these concerns. To address infringement of privacy issues, only the essential information that each institution requires, like age, birth date, and license number, can be displayed to prevent unnecessary exposure of personal information. In addition, the license will only be registered to one device that is registered in the license holder's name. And when it is reported lost or stolen, the license will no longer display. To make it difficult to forge or falsify, the license will be encrypted. And in addition, the authenticity of the ID can be confirmed by individuals and institutions through a separate app created for the purpose of verifying such IDs.
Okay, so it looks like they have been trying to cover all of the bases. How does one go about getting it in South Korea then?
So for now, the initial issuance of the license will only be processed and designated at designated driver's license examination offices and police stations in Daejeon and Seoul, where license holders can apply regardless of where they live. And along with the initial verification, users will need to download Mobile 신분증 in Korean app to use the IDs. The government hopes that this will ease the inconveniences of having to carry physical ID cards, which also have received criticism for its lack of durability and ease of forgery.
Okay, so a major step in the digitization of IDs in Korea. Let's move on to our final story now, and it's an interview with the Korean-American Olympic gold medalist Chloe Kim that is causing quite a stir. Can you tell us more?
Yes. In the interview with Time magazine last week, Korean-American Olympic champion Chloe Kim went in-depth on how her life changed drastically after winning gold at the Pyeongchang 2018 Winter Games. She recalled that at one point she hated life and even threw her medal into the garbage, overwhelmed with the sudden attention, much of it negative, she received at such a young age.
Right, so it's quite the admission, and it follows other athletes in recent years, such as Simone Biles and Naomi Osaka, admitting to the mental strain that being an elite athlete can have. On that note, can you remind us of some of Chloe Kim's remarkable accomplishments already?
Of course. Kim made history when she became the youngest woman to win a gold medal in snowboarding at the 2018 Olympics in Pyeongchang, when she won the gold in women's snowboard halfpipe at 17 years old. And she was also the first female snowboarder to land back-to-back 1080s, which are three full rotations in the air, at an Olympics event, among other records. She will compete for Team USA in the 2022 Winter Olympics in Beijing.
Okay, going back to that piece, pressure, stress and tension are all elements that come hand in hand for competitors at an elite level, of course. How did such aspects affect Kim?
While Kim explained that she was appreciative of the love and support she received, she just wanted a day where she was left alone. When she discovered after returning home that she was not able to go to her favorite places without receiving stares. And Kim, who is self-described as bubbly under normal circumstances, feels much more at peace now after attending therapy and taking a break from snowboarding to attend college at Princeton University.
Right, it's quite a fascinating and open interview, actually. She also talks about her experiences with racism, so it's one to check out. We'll wrap it up there for Career Trending today. Jenny, it was wonderful to have you in the studio this week. Thank you for those stories, and we'll hopefully see you again soon.
Thank you, Tango.
It's time now for our weekly segment, Explore Korea, where we journey across the peninsula, discovering more about the country's history, culture, and travel highlights. Joining us this week is our travel contributor, Hannah Roberts, ready to introduce us to some places to visit in Korea. Hannah, welcome back. It's good to see you.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here again.
Okay, so where are you taking us today?
So if you remember last year, we talked about BTS bringing visitors to Korea through their kind of their locations across Korea related to their music videos or their album cover shoots.
Sure.
You know, the power of K-pop is undeniable when it comes to bringing in tourism, tourists from across the world.
Of course.
But I'm going to say something here, but I think that K-dramas are just as, if not more powerful than K-pop at bringing people to Korea, particularly in terms of traveling around the country.
Of course. I mean, it's long been a popular tourism idea because you can visit film sets in various locations made famous by K-drama. So it's definitely a rich area to explore. So what led you to decide on this topic this week, though?
So it's winter right now. Mm-hmm. And when I said the word winter to myself, I thought immediately of the very famous show Winter Sonata.
Ah, yes, yeah. Of course.
It is one of the most famous K-dramas ever. I think that's quite easy to say. And it is also the drama that is credited with bringing Hallyu, which is also known in English as the Korean Wave, to the rest of Asia, particularly Japan and the Philippines. Now, Winter Sonata was mostly filmed on Namisom, which people probably know as Nami Island. Mm. And the power of drama is kind of proven by this. You know, visitors to the island increased nearly 300% just the year after its release. And visitor numbers are now over 3.3 million a year, which is something like 3,500% up from what it was the year before it was released.
Okay, as you say, you can definitely see the power of the K-dramas to bring in tourism.
Yes.
And the classic series actually marked its 20th anniversary this month as well. So it's all the more timely that you're bringing us this topic. So Nami Island, though, that's just the start, isn't it?
Yes, it really is. I feel like Nami Island is probably the most famous K-drama filming spot to visit for anyone coming to Korea. And there are a lot of other famous locations in the same area in Gyeonggi-do that people like to go to, like the Garden of Morning Calm, Petite France, the Edelweiss theme park that looks like Switzerland. but they're all very well known.
Right.
And there are a lot of other places which are really cool spots to go to, even if you're not into K-dramas. And so I'd like to introduce those today.
Okay, so perhaps some of the lesser known K-drama filming locations. Let's get cracking. Where are we headed to first?
So first we're going up to the city of Pocheon, and there are two spots here that I'd like to introduce. They're also, they're both very closely located together. They're both in the Hantanggang River Geopark. And the first spot is Pidulginang Waterfall.
Okay.
So fans of the popular drama Kingdom, which is about a zombie outbreak during Joseon times, will probably recognize this place as the spot where the physician Sobi first finds the resurrection flower, and then she finds herself trapped on the other side of the pond, surrounded by zombies.
Right, okay. So yes, we're starting off quite a recent hit then, Kingdom.
Yes, very popular. One of my favorites too, if not my favorite. Ever. So the waterfall was formed several hundred thousand years ago.
Wow, yes, okay.
By a volcanic eruption that took place. And actually the entire geopark was formed by this volcanic eruption.
Okay.
So the name of it is comes from the creatures that make their home there, which is pigeons. They all build their nests in all the little nooks and crannies in the waterfall. So I think that's it's quite sweet.
Yeah, so sounds like a great place to start. This waterfall, as you said, featured in the series Kingdom. But I understand that it's not the only drama that's been filmed in around this location, right, in this geopark.
That's right, yeah. Very nearby is the Hantanggang River Sky Bridge, which has been the filming location for the show What's Wrong with Secretary Kim, about a woman who tries to quit her job working for a very picky boss, but in the end falls in love with him.
Mm.
However that works. Yeah, of course. And also for the very recent and very popular drama Crash Landing Into You, which is about a South woman who has a freak paragliding accident and crash lands in North Korea and then falls in love with a North Korean soldier that saves her.
As you do again, yes. So more recent hits then. And you said this all is around Geopark. Can you tell us more about this location? That sounds quite interesting.
Yeah, so according to UNESCO, who set up the Geopark program, a worldwide program, Geopark means a place that is ecologically, archaeologically, historically and culturally valuable areas that are promoting regional economic development through conservation, education and tourism. So that's what geopark means. So this particular geopark, the Hantanggang River Geopark, has many spots of ecological interest to see, including natural springs, waterfalls, these stunning valleys and outcrops of rock. But it's particularly interesting because of how it was formed, because of that volcanic formation.
Mm.
And it is, I think it's one of the only inland volcanic formations in Korea.
Right, that's fascinating. So even outside of the drama locations, it sounds like there's plenty to see here.
Definitely.
At Geopark. Can you tell us a bit more about how to get there?
Yeah, so it's a little far away from Seoul. So it will take 3 hours if you go by bus. It'll only cost you 4,000 won, and you can take the 3,200 or 3,006 intercity bus to Pocheon and then transfer to Village Bus 58 in Pocheon City. It will take you an hour and a half by car. There is no train to get there. It's a bit tricky,
right, so
to go.
Ideally, if you have a car, it will be the best.
Yes.
But you can get there. You just need to give yourself a little bit more time and some more planning. Okay, moving on. What's next?
Next, we're going to Dongducheon, which is actually on the way to Pocheon. So this one is for the cinema nerds or the retro lovers or people who are both.
Sure.
This place is featured in the show Reply 1988.
Mm.
The show is set in 1988, and it follows the lives of a group of high schoolers who live in the same neighborhood, and it follows their families and their lives, and it shows you culture from the late 80s, and it's another one of my favorite shows. It's so good.
Right.
It was the highest rated drama when it was released, and it is now still the fourth highest rated drama ever, based on its final episode.
Right, it was particularly popular here in Korea, would say, compared to perhaps some hits that are popular overseas as well.
Mm,
yeah, because of that historical kind of looking back,
nostalgia
factor.
Yeah. So in one of the later episodes, two of the main characters go on a date to this place, which is called Dongguang Theatre, Dongguang Geukjang, which is in Dongducheon. This cinema opened in 1959 and it is still operating now.
Mm.
And along with another cinema in the country, it claims it is the oldest in Korea. So we can say safely it is one of the oldest cinemas in Korea.
Mm.
There are only 283 seats and they only show a small selection of films. And as well, the opening hours are very varied. So if you do want to visit, it's safer to call up and find out when they're open.
Wow, so it's very small, very local.
Yes.
I understand that they've kept all of the old aesthetics to make it almost seem like you're stepping into a time machine when you visit.
They definitely have. It looks so cool.
So even if you aren't there for the drama location, it still sounds like a fun place to go and check out to see the latest blockbuster but set in an old Korean crumbling cinema.
Yes.
Okay, so can you tell us how to get there?
So it'll take you just over 2 hours to get there by bus, and you can take the 1101 intercity bus and then change to Village Bus 53-5 at Deokjeong Station. If you do want to take the subway, it's a little bit quicker at 1 hour 30. And you can take the subway line 1 direct to Borsan Station and then change to that same village bus, 53-5. Or you can just walk 15 minutes from the station.
Mm.
If you want to drive, it will take you the same amount of time as taking the subway would, an hour and a half.
Okay. Finally, for our last spot today, I believe you've brought us to a theme park of sorts.
I have, yes. It's not just a standard place. You know, this is a, it's a theme park now, but it was actually built for the drama that was, the first drama that was filmed there.
Right, okay.
It was built as the filming location for the drama The Legend, whose main character is played by Pei Yong-jun, who probably know him.
Right.
He is from Winter Sonata.
Exactly, yes. So we're going back to what we talked about earlier.
Yeah. And as of, even as of now, for this drama, he was the highest paid drama actor ever.
Mm.
He was paid 250 million won per episode. What was that, like $250,000 around that?
Sure, yes.
Yeah.
Exactly, yes.
Average. So, you know, this place is this place is a big deal.
Mm.
So it's interesting to me because most historical places across Korea that tourists tend to visit focus on the Joseon and Silla periods.
Mm.
You know, sometimes the Baekje period, but there are very few places dedicated to the Goguryeo kingdom,
mm.
Owing mostly to the split of the Korean peninsula,
sure.
of course.
Of course, yes.
So, you know, it's a place where you can experience Goguryeo life.
Mm.
And this place is called the Goguryeo Blacksmith's Village.
Okay.
In the village, you can see kind of standard housing of the time, as well as a Goguryeo style steel mill, the house of a village chief, so a special house there. And you can also see a Mongolian village there as well.
Mm.
So it was designed actually as an ecological park. So it was built mostly from stone and wood. But it also has the largest water mill and also brick oven in Korea, which is fascinating. It's a K-drama set, but it has
a
two-story brick oven. Yeah, it's so interesting. So this place is actually on Achesan Mountain, which is in the city limits of Seoul. It's a really easy hike on Achesan Mountain, which also has Achesansong Mountain Fortress,
mm.
of course. And if you want some real history, you can visit the sentry posts that were actually built during Goguryeo times.
It's fascinating. So you can actually see the film sets, but also the original historical places that perhaps some of these film sets were inspired by.
That's
as
right,
well.
Yeah.
Interesting. And you said it's just on the edge of Seoul. How do we get there?
So you can take the subway line 2 to Gangbyeon Station or subway line 5 to Gwangnaru Station and then take the village bus number 1. I can't tell you how long it'll take because I don't know where you might stay in Seoul.
Yeah, right,
so it will
course.
Depend.
Mm.
But if you drive from central Seoul, it will take you 30 minutes in the car or 12,000 won in a taxi.
Okay, it's not too far.
No.
Okay, so Hannah, we'll wrap it up there. Thank you for introducing us to some of these perhaps lesser known K-drama filming locations. They still sound like fun, though.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk to you next time and take care.
Thank you. Bye.
춤추듯 날린 꽃잎 위로 그대의 웃음 덧대어지면
My name is Son Tae-jin. You're now listening to Korea 24.
봄으로 가득 찬
We finish up as usual with our closing segment, Morning Edition Preview, where we take a look at some interesting features or reports coming out in tomorrow's English language newspapers here in Korea. And for that, we have our staff editor, Mark Wilson Chair, joining us now in the studio. Mark, hello. It's good to see you.
Good to see you too.
Okay, so where are we headed to first?
We head to the Hallyu section of tomorrow's Korea Times. Kwak Hyun-soo's piece features Seohyun, actress and member of the K-pop great Girls' Generation, with her upcoming debut in film. The Netflix original film Love and Leashes is a bitingly funny rom-com, according to Kwak, but as the name suggests, it has a lot of adult humor and situations.
Yes, the subject matter has raised quite a few eyebrows, it seems. If we put it frankly, BDSM in nature. Mm-hmm. That's what has featured heavily in the promotional material that has caught a lot of people's attention. And the casting of Sayan has also attracted a lot of attention as well. This isn't her first time on the streaming platform, but it is her first time in film.
Yeah.
With all that in mind, can you tell us more about this film?
Sure. Sayan said that the film moves away from traditional rom-coms, but enabled her to understand that such romantic relationships, they can exist. Director Park Hyun-jin said Sayan did a superb job in expressing a cold and blunt demeanor, and viewers will get to see new facets of the K-pop star turned movie actress.
Yes, at the moment it does seem like there's a lot of interest. We'll see how well it does and what the final product is like as well. Okay, let's move on. Where are we headed to next?
We head to the issue and data section of tomorrow's Korea Herald. Amid the recent controversy surrounding the reality TV star / influencer Song Ji-ya, aka Frigia, who was caught donning counterfeit luxury goods, Ji-eun writes that South Korea's counterfeit market is very much alive. Ji takes us to Dongdaemun Market, the center of the nation's apparel and fashion industry. There you can find what's called a secret spot, where you can find heaps upon heaps of counterfeit goods. Now, though all are welcome, Ji writes, sellers warn people to not take photos or videos. They have every reason to be cautious and careful, as those who violate the local trademark law can face up to 7 years in the slammer, or pay up to 100 million won in fines. That's over $83,000.
Right, but according to the report, business is still booming.
Absolutely. You see, unlike other countries, in South Korea, there is no law that will punish buyers. According to data compiled by the Korea Customs Service, over 460 billion won worth of counterfeit bags were seized in January 2017 to August last year, and that's just bags. Now, one expert told the Herald why so many goods are bought. It has a lot to do with the nation's obsession with trends and to look good. And, of course, this is just glazing over what this expert said. To learn more, pick up tomorrow's Herald.
Right. It's the pressure to be able to try and show that you have perhaps luxury goods, though you can afford luxury goods. Mm-hmm. There is that pressure here in South Korea, unfortunately. So I guess that is helping fuel this illegal market, certainly. Okay, we'll wrap it up there for Morning Edition Preview. Thank you for bringing us those stories, Mark, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Talk to you then.
Now, our show will be taking a break tomorrow, and instead we'll be airing an old KBS World Radio special called Welcome to Songdaegul Energy Village. But we will be back on Monday with some Lunar New Year holiday special segments and a special Olympics interview as well, so we hope you can join us then for that. In the meantime, we hope you have a great weekend. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and thank you as always for listening. Goodbye.
KBS World Radio.